The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello all, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. And although today's show will be about skepticism and evidence-based practice within the realm of alternative health, and yes, that's possible, I want to start out by talking a bit about something that's currently near and dear to the skeptical heart, H1N1. It's on everyone's minds lately. It comes up at work, in the line at the bank, in every second news story, and on Facebook. And Facebook is the worst offender for misinformation. You can't expect much from a site that also offers Farmville and Mafia Wars, but unfortunately that's where many people are getting their information. There's even a little application that you can take to assess your risk of H1N1. And from what I've heard, it doesn't actually ask you any questions. Instead, there's a box that pops up that simply says, "What are my odds of catching swine flu?" And then it picks a number out of the air, apparently. The number given is usually between 1 and 8%, and after it gives you that complex risk analysis, it spams your friends list. Good times. So who exactly would consider Facebook a credible source of medical information? Well, the 15,317 people that have joined the Refusing the H1N1 Swine Flu Vaccine fan page. The studies and articles linked to include everything from 20 reasons why vitamin D is better than the swine flu vaccine, and videos named The CDC's Vaccination Genocide. So whether you like it or not, people are considering this solid science. So in order to have at least some evidence-based information available to curious Facebookers, Kim Hebert, one of the contributors to the blog SkepticNorth.com, made a group of her own. It's called H1N1 Vaccine, Get the Facts. And oh look, it has facts. There are rational, non-hysterical discussions, backed up by links to studies and articles, on everything from mercury to risks versus benefits analysis to how vaccines work. And best, there are actual medical professionals there. If you have a question, just post it to the wall and someone will answer it. And quickly. And Kim has made some of the Skeptic North contributors admins, of which I am one, and they're working hard to keep the group anti-vax free so that only actual science remains. But this doesn't mean that if you don't agree that we'll shut you down, because that is not the case. As long as you keep it civil and evidence-based, you are more than welcome to contribute to the conversation. And also, particularly welcome and encouraged to contribute are health professionals. If you're a doctor or a nurse or an immunologist, perhaps, your help is needed. Some days there are a lot of questions that need answering. I myself have been using the group to find quick cut and pastable links that I can post on other people's Facebook walls when their status updates say things like, "I don't know whether I should get the H1N1 shot," or "I just joined the Refusing the H1N1 Swine Flu Vaccine group." So again, Kim's group is called H1N1 Vaccine, Get the Facts. And if you can't find it that way, Kim has also written about the group on SkepticNorth.com. And just so you know, the Refusing group has 15,317 members, while ours has 783. This is an uphill battle, folks. And as I desperately don't want Skeptically Speaking to end up an entire hour about H1N1, let's move on to happier topics. Our Speaking Up segment today is Science Online 2010, and our guest is Bora Zivkovic. Bora grew up in Yugoslavia, now Serbia, and moved to the U.S. in 1991. He studied how birds' brains measure the time of day and time of year at North Carolina State University, and he's now the online community manager at the Public Library of Science, the open-access publisher of scientific and biomedical literature. He blogs on a blog around the clock at scienceblogs.com, teaches Bio 101 to non-traditional students at North Carolina Wesleyan College, He edits the annual anthology of the best writing on science blogs, and he organizes the annual Science Online Conference. Thanks very much for being here, Bora.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us a little bit about Science Online.
Science Online 2010 is the fourth annual conference, which started out, 4 years ago when my friend Anton Zeiker and I sat down over coffee and thought, we could get together some scientists, science bloggers, web developers, science teachers from the area, the Triangle area of North Carolina, get together for a day and discuss how web is changing science and how science is changing the web. So we organized it on the UNC campus, and immediately it became, instead of a local, an international conference with people coming from Europe and Canada. It has grown over the 4 years, and now it's 2.5 days long and has attendees coming from as far away as New Zealand, Brazil, Serbia, Poland, and other places.
Wonderful. And it's in North Carolina.
Yes, it's always in North Carolina in the Research Triangle Park, mm-hmm. Which is in the middle, in the center between Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill.
So what kind of panels and workshops are scheduled for this year?
The conference actually covers a wide range of topics on how the web is changing the way science is done, how scientists find each other and collaborate, how science is communicated, popularized, taught in the classrooms, and also how scientists can help change the way web works.
And there are a few notable people attending this year.
There are always notables, but mm-hmm. our notion is that everybody who comes to our conference is an expert in something and can teach something and learn something. So we try not to point out particular individuals who are particularly famous, because we think that everybody can contribute something to the discussion. And the conference is in an unconference format, which is based on the premise that the collective wisdom and knowledge of the people in the audience is always greater than the collective wisdom and knowledge of the people on the stage. Thus, people in the audience should be doing all the talking, and people on the stage are just moderating, making sure that the conversation is not hogged by anybody or goes off on tangents, but actually stays on the topic.
And that's brilliant. That's very inclusive, and that's somewhat unlike a regular conference. This is a particularly different format.
Yes, we like that. We relish that reputation. That our conference is very inclusive. It is, this is essentially a techie conference, and unlike most techie conferences, which are dominated by people who look like me, my age, skin color, gender, ours is really actually well known for having a great gender balance, age balance. We have always several high school kids. We have people in their 70s and everybody in between. Every color imaginable, and everybody feels comfortable because nobody is playing, alpha male over anybody else.
Wonderful, wonderful. And this conference isn't just for bloggers, correct?
No. I would say that about a third of the attendees are active bloggers. Others may have some blogs, maybe corporate blogs or journalistic blogs. This year there is going to be actually quite a lot of science writers and journalists and journalist students. There's always a nice contingent of science teachers, middle school, high school teachers, quite a lot of science librarians, local scientist students. So it's definitely not just about blogging. Blog is just one type of software, one way of using the web. There are many others.
And so right now, is the conference sold out?
Yes, we had to close for registration within 3 days after opening because we have to limit it to 250 because of the size of the venue. Mm-hmm. So it filled up with 250 people in 3 days over a weekend. So it's full. But we are going to try as much as we can to live stream online everything that's happening, have chat rooms so people who are watching virtually from somewhere else can put in the questions, which are going to be read and answered in the session. And we encourage everybody there to cover all the sessions and cover the whole conference live as much as possible with, you know, audio and video and on Twitter, on their blogs, on Facebook, wherever they want, wherever they like. And we are going to try to pool all those sources together in one place where it's going to be easy to find everything in as real time as we can manage.
Now, I do have to give a plug. I was just asked to be on a panel with P.Z. Myers and Dr. Kiki and Greg Layden and Stephanie Zvon. I hope I only read it. I don't actually say it out loud.
I think you pronounce it all right.
Oh, really? Yay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm quite ecstatic. That's going to be a brilliant panel. And so it will be webcast.
Yes.
Wonderful.
It is very interesting. Usually after the fact, after the conference is over, we can figure out which was the underlying thread of most of the sessions. And last year it was the question of power, how the web is changing the power structures, giving new people power, changing who is the gatekeeper, who is outside the gates. And it seems, just looking at the program and how the moderators are putting the descriptions, that the theme of this year is going to be trust. How do you get to be trusted? How do you figure out who to trust? If you're a scientist, which journalist to trust? If you're a journalist, which scientist to trust? And your session, the one that you're going to be doing with Stephanie, Greg, Kirsten, and PZ, is very specifically about trust and critical thinking, how to figure out which scientific sources are credible online, because, of course, we know there's a lot of quackery online as well as very good science.
So how can people find out more about the conference?
The website, scienceonline2010.com, has a link to the wiki where the whole community of attendees has kind of built the wiki, the program over the months, and all the information is there, and there will be more as far as how to plug in and watch it virtually. We'll try even Second Life, so that it's not limited just to the 250 people on the ground, but to everybody else who is interested. Those who are not there, they'll have to buy their own beer.
Very good. Really? You're buying the beer for the people who are there? This was not mentioned.
There will be some beer and some wine on us. We have received sponsorship from several local and not just local organizations, and it seems like we'll be able to cover quite a lot of meals for our attendees for free.
That's fantastic.
Risi Triangle Foundation, Risi Triangle Park, Burroughs Welcome, National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, RTI are all contributing to our conference so we can run it well, so it's successful.
That's wonderful. And I would advise people to start thinking about this for next year, since you aren't going this year.
We are looking for a bigger venue because obviously the interest in the conference is bigger than what we can hold right now.
Which is a great sign. And thank you so much, Bora, for being here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I'll see you in January.
Absolutely. And we'll be right back with Paul Ingraham, skeptical alternative science health practitioner, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. So contrary to that ad, we're not taking phone calls today, as the internet in the entire building is down, which is great for this show that is mainly internet-based. But as almost everyone on the Skeptically Speaking team has iPhones, your emails and your tweets are still welcome and encouraged. So we're on the line today with Paul Ingraham. Paul's a science journalist and a skeptical registered massage therapist with a busy hands-on practice in downtown Vancouver. Writing steadily about healthcare since 1997, he founded a publishing company that's authored 8 books and hundreds of articles so far about science-based care for common pain problems like knee pain, muscle pain, low back, and neck pain. All of his work is published on saveyourself.ca. So as a skeptical insider in a profession not known for being terribly science-based, Paul's exactly the kind of person I like to interview on this show. But in the last couple of years, his career has gotten a lot more interesting. Paul criticizes questionable practices in alternative healthcare, and his professional regulator has alleged that it's offensive. It wants to reprimand him for professional misconduct and censor saveyourself.ca. There's some similarities here to another high-profile legal battle, the one between Simon Singh and the British Chiropractic Association. So we've got a lot to talk about. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Paul. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Des.
So tell us about the website, first of all.
Sure. Saveyourself.ca is my baby. It's where I do all my writing, and I've been doing it for, about a decade, give or take. And my goal is to provide science-based troubleshooting information for a whole bunch of common pain problems. And the great challenge of this is that there's really actually not an awful lot of good evidence and science-based care for pain problems. So it's a real maze for health consumers to sort their way through it. My goal is to help them figure out what works and what doesn't and why.
And it's a massive site.
It is. It's absolutely gigantic. It even depends on how you count the words because it draws from databases and so on, but I think it's roughly 1.5 million words, which is well over the 8 books that I definitely have. There's 8 ebooks that finance the site. Sales of ebooks and advertising revenue is what keeps me going.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that I'm most proud of is that I think that saveyourself.ca is possibly the only website on earth that is turning a profit by selling ethical, science-based health information. Generally speaking, you can only make money online by making really big promises and using hard sell tactics and offering miracle cures. And I refuse to do any of that. And it's, believe me, there's days when I'm tempted. It would be so easy to just put a couple of big promises in the introductions to my ebooks, and I would probably triple my sales, and that would be exciting. But can't do it, and won't ever do it.
Well, the site says that you offer science-powered advice about your stubborn aches, pains, and injuries. So what does that mean? What does science-powered mean?
Science-powered is, that's kind of a reference to the idea of science-based medicine as opposed to evidence-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And science-based medicine is a term coined by the Yale neurologist Steve Novella,
mm-hmm.
and popular podcaster, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Many of your listeners are going to know exactly who I'm talking about. And the basic idea of science-based medicine is that not only do you take into consideration the available clinical evidence, but also the basic plausibility of the idea being discussed. Does it make any sense? Is it consistent with the existing body of knowledge? And the reason that's important is because pure evidence-based medicine can get abused and be used as a way to drag arguments on for years about the state of the evidence, when the basic idea was never any good to begin with. And the classic example of that would be homeopathy, which has very low plausibility. And yet, because evidence-based medicine is devoted to evaluating things only in terms of whether or not there's any evidence, it allows homeopaths to
debate and argue endlessly that there is evidence, when in fact others believe there is not. So the philosophy of SaveYourself.ca is really inspired by Steve Novella's idea of science-based medicine. Let's talk about what makes sense, as well as what the evidence is.
So how does this affect the treatment that you offer then?
It means that I do an awful lot of disclaimering, and I am really open with people and self-deprecating about my concerns about the limitations of the treatments that I offer. There's very little that I do that is evidence or science-based. It's massage therapy is, there's a lot of reasons to believe that it might be helping people, but there's an awful lot in the field that is pretty dubious. And so when I offer treatments, I just do an awful lot of saying, I don't know if this works, and I don't want you to waste your money. Here's why I think it might work, and because we don't have any other good options, let's decide together whether or not you're going to take a chance on it. So just lots of informed consent.
Well, one of the things that that really makes your website quite different from a lot of alternative health sites are citations, references.
Yeah.
So, and because sometimes when you look at other health sites, they may have citations and references and such, but then you link, you click on them, and they are dubious.
Yeah.
So, how do you decide what you refer to on your site?
I'm really proud of my citations. I've busted a gut to produce really high-quality referencing. Way back in the beginning, I noticed that even good sources of information about health tended to lack good citations.
Mm-hmm.
Even scientific journals, they would have, you know, very awkwardly coded footnotes that didn't make it easy to check the reference. You know, and in the early days of the internet, an awful lot of references couldn't be checked online. You had to go to an actual library.
Remember those?
Yeah. I haven't been in one in a while.
No.
I've been in Wikipedia. And I've been in a lot of scientific journal sites. But boy, it's been a long time since I've looked something up in a library. And that's because these days you can refer to scientific research, to scientific papers directly, and you can send your readers there. And you should. It's really important that citations be auditable, that readers can check them for themselves. That transparency is critical to good quality health information because it prevents sloppy, meaningless citation. It's really common for people trying to promote a service or a product to, you know, hit you with three or four citations. They don't make it easy to check them, but if you do, you find out that they're really not very relevant.
Oh, agreed.
And sometimes they literally even contradict the point that the author was trying to make. So I have literally invested thousands of dollars and countless hours in creating an almost completely invisible system that makes it almost effortless for me as a publisher and as a writer to produce really high-quality citations that are checkable. And occasionally I get emails from librarians saying, wow, nice system.
Well done.
And they're pretty, I think they're pretty much the only ones who notice or care. Most people, it's totally transparent, but I've made this massive investment in making it possible to cite well. And I honestly think that I'm doing it better than almost every other source of information online.
Now, audience, if you have a question about massage therapy or science-based alternative health, you can email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we actually have a question submitted via the website before the show. Go ahead, Ryan.
Question is, if you found out that a treatment that you did regularly was not supported by science, how would you react?
Oh, I'd stop doing it, and I have done that. There are numerous cases of therapies that I used to believe in that I no longer do. In fact, my range is getting a little limited over the years.
Really?
Yeah, I'm down to a fairly small set of treatments that I think are worth my fee. And I pretty routinely turn people away and just, you know, refuse to treat them because I don't think it's worth it. And I will quite assertively tell people, nope, sorry, I don't think you should pay me.
Well, so what is massage therapy good for?
The most likely plausible benefit of massage therapy is the effect that squishing muscle has on a ubiquitous muscle dysfunction called muscle knots in plain speak, or technically known as myofascial trigger points. And these little patches of toxic contracted muscle are pretty well-described clinical entity. There's not much doubt that they exist. There is a great deal of doubt about how they work, how to treat them, whether or not therapists can reliably diagnose them. They are almost certainly there, but they're kind of hard to deal with. To the extent that massage generally seems to produce an awful lot of satisfied clients, it is probably because so many people have this common muscle dysfunction. It's kind of like the acne of your muscles. Almost everybody's got at least some. Some people have quite a few. It causes an awful lot of the world's aches and pains. And squishing muscles seems to help. Your mileage will vary. It really totally fails to help some people, either because there's something else entirely going on, or because muscle squishing just isn't that good at relieving the pain of trigger points.
So you would say that in certain situations it doesn't help?
Absolutely.
Okay, now, are your responses to these kind of questions unusual within alternative health?
Yeah, alternative healthcare professionals, as a general rule, are not that inclined to be self-deprecating about their services. I've made such a habit of it now that it's really standard and automatic for me. But I don't think it's terribly common. The willingness to say, you know, I don't know if this works, and in fact there's concerns about it, and maybe you shouldn't waste your money on it, it's just not very, very common in healthcare in general, I think. Doctors are pretty good at it, but not so much alternative.
Right. So these kind of responses to questions about other alternative health practices as well have made you not so popular. I know a lot of people are listening specifically to hear about this, so we'll get right into it.
Sure. The criticisms I have of alternative healthcare don't go over that well with some members of the profession, of course. There's a basic split in all of the alternative health professions between professionals who are interested in being the alternative to large-scale, depersonalized, and institutionalized medicine and providing a service that is rational and science-based. That's one side.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, there's people who believe that there are alternative healthcare professionals to be the alternative to science. And they specifically want to offer treatments that aren't scientific or that stand in opposition or contrast to what science-based medicine provides. And that's a mark of pride for many of them.
Mm-hmm. And you write about this
all the time. Yeah.
And
it's a minority of my content.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
Overall, probably only about 5% of what I've produced is directly about problems in alternative care. And, my debunkery is not the majority of my work. Mostly I'm interested in helping people to understand how pain problems work and what you might be able to do about them. But, of course, that occasionally takes me down the path of doing a reality check and saying, well, what about this really popular therapy? Is there anything to it? Does it work?
For example, that's
where I've gotten into trouble.
Right. For example, chiropractic.
Right. Although it's very important to say that chiropractic is not one therapy any more than massage is one therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Chiropractic is a professional designation, and particularly due to some of my legal troubles, I am getting more and more cautious about criticizing the profession.
Right.
And I'm more interested in talking instead about interventions, things that health professionals do with their patients, and talking about whether or not those things work, regardless of who does them.
Well, what have you written about specifically in regards to chiropractic on your website?
My legal challenges began with a pretty brief summary of the chiropractic profession. About, I don't know, I probably wrote it about 5 or 6 years ago. And it was a bit sassy. It wasn't rude, I don't think. I'm sure that some chiropractors thought it was rude, but it was basically a pretty well-researched summary of the controversies in the profession. And that led to a couple of chiropractors sending letters of complaint to my professional regulator, the College of Massage Therapists of BC. That's the agency responsible for granting my credentials. And their job is to make sure that the public is safe from massage therapists, and the massage therapists are qualified and they aren't doing anything unsafe, and that we're all terribly professional. And the College of Massage Therapists responded to the complaint by accusing me of ethical misconduct, that my writing was unacceptably offensive and too strongly worded. And we've been on a roller coaster of negotiations ever since. It's been almost 2.5 years now.
What exactly did you say? Did they say exactly what you said, or did they say the whole thing that you shouldn't be? And who said this?
Yeah, it began with the complaint. So the complaining chiropractors made some points, and then the inquiry committee of the CMT kind of took it upon themselves to analyze my content and issue their editorial opinion in the form of a reprimand. And it's basically a matter of opinion whether or not what I've written constitutes something that's insulting to other health professionals. And in their opinion, it does. And in my opinion, it does not. So, for instance, the very specific, the rule that I've broken, the mm-hmm. thing that they think I was not supposed to do, was respect the honor, dignity, credibility of other health professionals. That's a line in our code of ethics. I am supposed to respect the honor, dignity, and credibility of other professionals. And they think that my writing constituted disrespecting the honor, dignity, and credibility of other professionals. Another rule that I have allegedly broken is that I'm not supposed I should refrain from undue criticism of the qualifications or therapies provided by other massage therapists or other practitioners. So again, they allege that my writing constitutes undue criticism, but this is a matter of editorial opinion, and that's what we've been negotiating and discussing ever since. Is discussing the science undue criticism? Is referring to the existence of controversies and taking a position undue criticism? Is it undue to do it with a little bit of a sense of humor?
So have there actually been any communications from the Chiropractic Association?
No, I've never received any communication directly from the BC Chiropractic Association. I've been told repeatedly by the CMT that they keep complaining about me. By phone, not by letter. They have literally never submitted a complaint by letter, which is interesting to me.
So
I do get hate mail.
Do tell.
Yeah, my hate mail is kind of fun. I get a fair amount of hate mail from chiropractors who believe that Jesus is the source. Ranty emails with lots of capital letters.
Ooh, caps lock. That's how you know they're mad.
Yeah.
Is it in Comic Sans by any chance?
Yeah. My favorite hate mail ever was it was from a chiropractor in a prominent position, and he could not spell the word professional. He kept saying that he was more professional than I am, and every single time he used the word professional in his email, he spelled it a different way, and he also couldn't spell the word cervical, as in cervical spine. and
that's not
instead he
good.
Kept spelling it as cervix, cervical, as in a reference to the female anatomy. And I think that if there's any word that a chiropractor should be able to spell correctly, it should be cervical, as in cervical spine. But he misspelled it almost every single time in his message. And that man was, I won't say exactly who, but he was the president of a prominent chiropractic organization.
So has the college actually mentioned the word libel at any point?
No.
Or just unprofessional?
Exactly.
Okay.
And it would be extraordinarily difficult to make a charge of libel stick. Defamation requires, in Canada, a charge of defamation is very difficult. You really have to be extremely rude and factually inaccurate over and over again before anyone can successfully get you for defamation. There have been very, very few cases in Canadian legal history of successful defamation suits because it just really takes the most egregious attack on someone's reputation. And that's probably a great segue into Simon's case.
Absolutely.
I'm sure virtually everyone listening knows about Simon's case, but let's just quickly go over the basics here. My case is really similar to Simon Singh's case. It's not the same kind of legal trouble, but it's very similar in spirit. Simon is a brilliant science journalist in the UK. And he's written a bunch of books, and he's into physics and math. And recently he wrote a book about alternative health care with Edzard Ernst, a really distinguished professor of alternative medicine. And that book was quite critical of many practices in alternative health care, just as I am. Simon followed it up with an article in the Guardian newspaper and was subsequently sued for that article, for the content of that article, by the British Chiropractic Association. And this is a big problem for anyone in the UK. English defamation law is insane. It has some really nasty characteristics. The costs of defending yourself are extortionate. It bizarrely places the burden of proof on the defendant, and the facts are useless in your defense. So, for instance, here in Canada, if I wanted to sue you for defamation, I'd have to prove that you'd harm my reputation. Mm-hmm. And you could defend yourself if your statements about me were true. In the UK, it would go down very differently. All I would have to do to make the feces hit the rotary air distributor would be to establish that my reputation was harmed. I just have to claim it. And then having done that, you would be considered guilty of it until you could prove that you hadn't harmed my reputation, and you couldn't use mere facts in your defense. They're irrelevant in English defamation law. And so the result is that it's incredibly easy for people to sue for defamation in the UK and scare the crap out of the victim, because it can literally cost £1 million, British pounds.
Absolutely.
To defend yourself.
And it prevents people from speaking out, because that is a huge risk to take.
Right. And that is what Simon Singh's case is all about. It's about legal bullying. It's about the British Chiropractic Association using its legal muscle to attack him and discourage him from discussing scientific controversies, rather than discussing the issues and the evidence. They attacked him legally, and it's an extremely effective attack in the UK. So to go back to your question about libel and me, no one's going to be able to sue me for libel here. It just won't work, because I'm just not mean enough. There's just nothing on my website that's nasty enough that anybody could get me on a claim of defamation. So the whole issue, my issue with the CMT, is all about interpretation of our code of ethics. And the entire thing boils down to the fact that they think that my tone is unprofessional.
Audience, again, if you want to get into the conversation, I know we don't have our phone today, which is very unfortunate, but we are taking emails. It's live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. We do have an email now.
This question comes from KO with Grassroots Skeptics. Successfully defending against even a frivolous defamation suit brought by an alt-med industry group takes a lot of time and money. Do you think that skeptics should look at starting a legal defense fund to help support folks targeted by these kinds of litigation?
Yeah, I think that would be lovely.
Because you have hired a lawyer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't spent a great deal of money on my case yet, but I have spent an awful lot of time and energy.
Mm-hmm.
There's, been a pretty high distraction factor for a couple of years now. There's really a bright side to it. It's an incredible honor to have been targeted. You're doing something right in life when you're irritating a certain kind of person. And I am genuinely pleased that my writing is provocative enough, that it's interesting enough to generate this kind of attack. It means I'm doing something right, but it's also harrowing. And there are a number of similar cases around the world. I'm delighted to have had a brief email conversation with Simon Singh just a couple of days ago. And in that conversation, we talked about similar cases around the world. And we know of 5 in total around the world right now. There's six of them. His and mine. David Colquhoun, I'm sure I butchered that pronunciation, in New Zealand. Sean Holt in New Zealand. And the New South Wales Skeptics in New Zealand. All having legal troubles. All being bullied for trying to talk about science. And then, of course, Stephen Barrett of Quackwatch.org is more or less constantly besieged with legal harassment. And I think there's few things that the skeptical community could do that would be, few more valuable things that the community could do than try to get organized around supporting people who are fighting battles like this.
And on that note, we'll be back with more science-facilitated infighting right after this.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be exploring human research ethics with Nancy Walton, PhD. Remember that study that asked participants to deliver electric shocks to people to study their obedience to authority? We'll be talking about that. And randomized trials on orphaned and abandoned children. And how we research the effects of torture, and if we should be doing it at all. And what happens when clinical trials result in death? Everything you ever want to know about the ethics of studying us. On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking. Every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time. Here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Paul Ingraham, science journalist and registered massage therapist, who's practicing science-based healthcare in a field that doesn't really seem to appreciate it. I also want to say I just peeked over at the chat room on Ustream, and you guys are hilarious. That's all I have to say.
I haven't looked.
Oh, it's there.
What's going on?
You'll have to look. I'm not going to talk about it on air. Most of it is censored.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting comment.
But so what are the potential repercussions for you with this?
The stakes for me are my license and several tens of thousands of dollars in legal defense fees. The worst case scenario for me is that I have to go through a full regulatory hearing with the result that I would have to pay all legal fees if I lost. So in that regard, it's actually strikingly similar to the UK problem, in that when you're sued for defamation in the UK, you end up paying for all expenses if you lose. And so, I've said that my case is like libel, but different. I'm not being sued, I'm being regulated. And it's a different kind of legal problem and an interesting one. It's a category of legal trouble I didn't even know existed until it happened to me. And if I have to fight in a hearing, then the legal expenses could get very high, and that's the worst case scenario for me.
We actually have another email.
Sure.
This email is from Kennedy. He asks, has this attack changed who you are, your self-image as a practitioner? I.e., are you now the skeptical RMT as opposed to just Paul, the West End massage guy? Has it pushed you further into the realm of science-based methodology?
Yeah, kicking and screaming. I'm delighted to have discovered the skeptical community as a result of my experiences. I was at TAM for the first time this year and have never made so many good new friends so quickly. There's tremendous advantages to being in this kind of difficulty. Really wonderful, really smart people have come to my aid and my defense. I've had an opportunity to be in the same room with, have good conversations with people like Stephen Novella, people like David Gorski, a.k.a. ORAC, the very prolific anti-quackery blogger, Harriet Hall, the skeptoc, Stephen Barrett of QuackWatch, Dale Bierstein, a professor of philosophy here in Vancouver, has been incredibly supportive. I've gotten to talk to all of these people and to pal around with them even to some extent. And your IQ goes up when you're
yes.
in the same room with some of
By
these
osmosis,
people.
Even. Yeah.
Beg pardon?
By osmosis.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, these are just the best people there are, and I'm in awe of their intelligence and their competence, and that they have vetted my website, given it a thumbs up, has absolutely sent me, you know, hurtling towards higher and higher standards for science-based writing. I mean, you would not believe the way I scramble to update things and fix things and study things. And I mean, I've just gone through the most unbelievable quality control process in the last year. As I have earned these supporters, I have also gone really deeply into trying to earn their respect and trust, and to make absolutely sure that there's nothing on Save Yourself that would embarrass them for supporting me. So, yeah, it's changed me radically, and it's introduced me to some of the best thinking on Earth, and given me opportunities to discuss these issues with the most qualified people imaginable. And, it's a great honor and definitely a major transformation.
So if looking back on this now, is there anything you would have changed? Would you have used softer language? Would you have used different language? Would you not have taken this on at all?
Yeah, I've soul-searched a lot on that. Of course, you know, one reason that I could have been gentler was simply to avoid getting into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Another reason that I might have been softer is out of a genuine sympathy for the CMT's concern. My initial responses to the inquiry committee's allegations, not just my initial responses, all my responses, I have bent over backwards to show respect for the issue, for the concern. I want to win hearts and minds. I don't want to write stuff that offends anyone. And yet, at the same time, I find myself inexorably drawn towards saying things in an entertaining way.
And that's one of the things about your site, is it's quite funny.
Thanks. Good. Score.
And that's also unusual.
It is. It's
because I laugh at actually other alt health sites, but not quite for the same reason.
Yeah, I try to make it funny. I mean, it's dry subject matter. There's not a heck of a lot of inherent humor, but I do my best. And this is a debate in the skeptical community. Should we be polite, or should we not be polite?
Mm-hmm.
How strongly should we state our concerns and our objections? And there are those among us who believe that we should state them very strongly. Mm-hmm. And what I find is that I just get I get pulled back and forth all the time, and I see the value in both, and I land on compromise. I'm a bit sassy. The sassometer only goes so far with me. I put my tongue in my cheek quite a lot, but I generally don't go past that. I never swear. No mamas. No personal insults. I don't get mean. At worst, I get sassy. And I don't think I can change that. I'm a writer, and my job is to express these ideas as well as I can. And humor is a very important way of doing that.
What's your advice for other alt health practitioners that maybe are considering becoming more science-based, or maybe are skeptics and they're not speaking about it publicly?
Well, I don't want them to get in trouble, but I also want them to speak out. I know a lot of alternative health professionals who have concerns about pseudoscientific and anti-scientific practices in their profession. Some of the progressive chiropractic community is incredible. There are many critics of the chiropractic profession within the chiropractic profession. I get hate mail from chiropractors, but I also get fan mail. So this division, it's everywhere in alternative healthcare. And generally speaking, progressive alternative health professionals have lost the battle, and alternative healthcare is now substantially dominated by pseudoscientific and anti-scientific thinking. We could have been the alternative to institutionalized care, more personal, more friendly, basically all about good bedside manner.
Right.
But the public now mainly understands alternative health care as being all about what the doctors won't offer you. And that is really unfortunate. So my advice to alternative health practitioners is to think, what are you the alternative to? And don't be the alternative to science. Science has a strong role to play in all healthcare.
On that point, we actually have another email.
Sure.
This email from John, he asks, why do you think that many people view science-based medicine with negativity and suspicion? Is it justified or at least understandable?
It's certainly understandable. There's, you know, a lot of pretty obvious reasons why people are flocking to alternative healthcare, why they're turning away from what they call mainstream medicine. And it's the depersonalization and the institutionalization. That's, I believe, the primary driving force. People do not like the hospital experience, and for a lot of good reasons. And out of a lack of awareness for what science-based medicine really means, they associate science with impersonal healthcare. And they're separate issues. Science-based care can be incredibly compassionate, personal. The problem with healthcare being delivered in a way that turns people off is it has really nothing to do with science. And yet, that's the connection that gets made,
right?
To my great sadness, because science is like democracy, imperfect but the best game in town.
Nicely
we don't
put.
Have a better tool for figuring out how things really work,
right?
And wishful thinking in healthcare is really dangerous. It's quite tragic the extent to which people waste extraordinary amounts of time and money on stuff that never had a really realistic hope of working. And I see an awful lot of cases like that. And we're not talking about critical stuff like where, you know, someone goes and gets a quack cancer cure and dies as a result.
Right.
But just tragic wastes of time and money.
Well, on that depressing note, we have one quick question, but Paul, I don't think it's for you. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yes, this is sent in by Eric. He asks, how is the D&D Light campaign to stop smoking coming along?
For anybody that was listening to that episode, we tried to quit smoking. We tried to use the patented MC Frontalot GM Your Own Habit Abatement campaign method. It worked poorly, really. worked very poorly. It was very fun, and I got a character sheet out of it. But on that note, Eric, thanks for your question. And Paul, thank you so much for being on the show.
No problem. Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
Can I tell people about a page to go to
on my site for
more info?
Please do.
SaveYourself.ca/censored. And you'll get the full details that I can reveal at this time.
And I do suggest meandering about through the rest of the site. It was I took a lot longer researching for this show because Paul's site is actually entertaining. So set aside some time.
Have fun and send me an email, and I'm wide open to constructive criticism. I love to hear from readers.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Paul.
Thank you.
And check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, you can join our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, or subscribe to the show in iTunes. And while you're in iTunes, please do consider writing a review of the show. We very, very, very much appreciate that kind of thing. We'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie.
Everything you believe is a lie.